to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today.
There are several things that I hadn't thought of before until Nancy asked me two or three questions. And one threw me completely, which was about how my parents treated me and what impact that may have had on the way I brought up my kids. And that is something I hadn't really thought of. So there was some thought here that I was not anticipating, but I'm glad it happened.
Welcome to another Monday with We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. Priscilla Vang owns a Payroll Vault franchise in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is our sponsor for today's mentoring conversation. Priscilla discovered through helping clients find tax solutions that they need a payroll service they can count on. She has taken her client-focused skills, accountancy degree, and technology-driven software tools to help business owners redefine how they do payroll. This saves time and money. Priscilla is passionate and dedicated to building trust over the long term with small business owners. With Priscilla, providing you with the best payroll service possible is what directs her life. You can reach her at 1-651-783-2509 or just click on the homepage at wementor.com and you will see a button to directly connect you with Payroll Vault and Priscilla. As I mentioned at the beginning of last week's show, our guest today for a second conversation is Peter Beaumont. And we talked about entrepreneurship, and I wanted to share with you that we're going to continue the journey so that you can hear how an entrepreneurial leader has shaped his life and how eventually he has moved to the United States to become an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurship refers to entrepreneurial activity within a larger organization to create something new, like a new product or service or a new concept, or in Peter's case, Coca-Cola's re-entry into the Middle East. You're about to hear a little bit more about that story. After a 22-year absence, Coca-Cola went back and wanted world domination. And a new distribution system that he set up for Philip Morris International, which is what you're about to hear about. If you're not already aware, Philip Morris is a leading tobacco company. Entrepreneurship typically represents an organizational level effort to organize and manage an internally generated venture. An advanced level of team building skills are needed to advance ideas and internally organize the new development. And as I mentioned last time in an upcoming episode, last week, I will be having a mentoring conversation with another entrepreneur, Art Fry, a former chemist with 3M. Minnesota is really known for their entrepreneurship, building out of teams within a company, especially through 3M. They have like the template and prototype for it. Art and Spencer Silver in 1974 invented the slightly sticky adhesive glue that's known as Post-it notes. So welcome again to a second mentoring conversation, Peter Beaumont.
Yeah. Thank you.
How are you feeling now?
Great, same as I did before. It doesn't seem that long ago since we got together. It's amazing. Time flies when you're having a wonderful time.
It does. So to give you a little bit more background about Peter, he's the founder and principal of ConXN Consulting. He is in the midst of revising a book he authored in 2014 called The Relationship Roadmap. The book is a 100-page comprehensive guide to building strategic relationships with clients. He's a global leader and marketer and author and speaker, trainer, facilitator, coach, entrepreneurial operational systems implementer, and a certified value builder. He's the team behind Your Team, focused on increasing the value of a small size to Fortune 500 companies. He works with owners through the process of being freed up from daily operations and allows visionaries to do what they do best, expand their reach. He's also running what I'm involved in, is the Small Emerging Growth Companies organization in the Twin Cities. You want to tell us a little bit more about the organization?
Yeah, sure.
It's so well run.
Thank you. It's a networking group. Well, it was called a networking group. I'll change that in a second in terms of the definition, because I don't think it is, but that's what it was set up for originally. It's been running for about 14 years, and I was asked to take it over last August. The three things we principally focus on is learning, having a speaker that will actually teach and transfer some skills that are necessary for solopreneurs and small business owners so they can walk out of the room with something they can use that they haven't used before. The second area is support. So it's not exactly therapy, but it can be close to it, because when you go out and transition into your own business, there's a lot of things you start missing. Resources, you're intellectually isolated, physically isolated in many cases. And so the support thing is very important to solopreneurs and small businessmen. And then the third area is what I call connecting rather than networking. How can we connect each other to our broader network where it will make sense, both commercially but also personally?
Yeah, and it's working really well for you.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'm enjoying it very much. It's become a main part of what I do now.
Yeah. And Priscilla Vang, our sponsor for today's episode, she's also a member.
Well, that's good to know.
You'll find out more when you see her soon.
Excellent.
Yes. And you grew up in Europe. Mm-hmm. What part of England?
England, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Canterbury, Kent, which is down the southeast tip, famous for the cathedral, and now Kent University is based there too.
Okay. And you've had a challenging youth with some illnesses that you've overcome, eczema. Yeah. And I'm trying to say it like you say it.
Eczema. It's going to take a bit while longer.
Well, yes. And your parents were very involved with sport, which helped you overcome being bullied.
Being bullied and generally being a sick child, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
they were both very determined. And my father actually served in India during the Second World War in the Indian Army. And so very Victorian type background. So, you know, I was brought up fairly strictly. Yeah, much more than my mother would probably have liked. But she was strict in her ways too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how has that informed you as a parent?
Do you know, that's a question I didn't expect.
I got to throw every guest off little bit.
Yeah, you did, because immediately it's like, oh, no, because I'm ready to answer it, but not in the way that I probably thought I would. Two things that I certainly decided when my first son was born, Max. He was born in Bahrain and a British hospital there. No problems, no complications of birth, everything fine. Although I was able to tell my wife at the time that she had preeclampsia, she didn't know. I studied everything. I told you I was process-driven on the last program, and I am. So I'd read everything you could know about pregnancy, and she was preeclampsic, got her down to the hospital pretty quickly. But the first thing I was determined not... One of the things that my dad never really did was play with me.
Oh.
So he would lecture me, teach me my maths. He would go out on the cricket pitch with me and bowl at me for hours on the ends so I would improve as a player. And I'll never forget, on his 90th birthday, I was down in New Zealand giving the speech for his 90th birthday, chosen by the family to do that. And I get to a point in the speech where I say, and you know, my dad was 3 P's and he was supportive of it, and I went through these things. And one of the things he was amazing at would go out on the pitch with me till late at night and bowl at me and make sure I... And
make sure you continued to improve.
And he couldn't stop himself. Yes, and he said, you'd have played for bloody England if you'd practiced longer. So obviously this had rankled with him for over 80 years or whatever. So anyway, probably 70.
You hear about it on the 90th birthday.
And by the way, Dad, this is your 90th birthday eulogy. It's not for you to talk, okay? You can tell me about it later. But So yeah, very determined, but didn't really play. And so I was determined that with Max I'd play. You know, stuff like firing water pistols at each other and, yeah, you know, just doing
goofy stuff.
Yeah, yeah, silly things together. So I actually ended up in his initial childhood bringing him up more than my wife. So I'd take him out on the boat. We had a boat down there because it's an island, right? So what else are you going to do?
Right.
So we had a little 17-foot ski boat. A friend of mine shared the cost of it. So I'd take him out on that. We go down to the marina club, which was a swimming pool area, and eat down there, like a country club, but on water.
Oh,
and
sure.
So we would do that fairly regularly. So I did a lot of stuff with him, and especially as I traveled quite a bit. So that was my... So I compensated a lot for what I didn't get from my dad. And I wasn't quite as strict as my wife, funnily enough. So so I think that did have an impact on me, the way I was brought up.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is, since I've had two more children by my second wife, I've changed again. I've noticed that I had the same expectations that my father did about, you respect me because I am who I am, as opposed to earning and getting trust for that respect.
Oh, I see.
And that's taken me a while to learn. You know, my 18-year-old is, she was at Eastview. She just graduated. She was in the debate club and did extremely well, reached the state. And she can hold her own with anybody, which, by the way, is a little bit unnerving for me, because normally I debate well and are one of these people that will often argue for the sake of arguing just to win the argument.
I see.
And try and hold the two views, you know, opposing views, and
sure,
just use whichever one was necessary at the time. She can beat me pretty well at that. And so I've struggled in the last couple of years with having a offspring argue at a young age, which I was never allowed to do.
Right.
With my father.
So it was like,
you were never,
how do I handle
you never,
that?
You were accused of being talking back.
Yeah, right.
And so I never had that issue with Max. And suddenly I had this issue with Carly. And so it's been a, hey, you know, this is your dad coming out. You got to ease off. So
yeah.
And see it through her eyes. And it's been a struggle. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my wife's helped me a lot with that.
Yeah. Well, we all have areas to grow in.
Yeah, so thanks for throwing that one in.
Sure, right. So in our first conversation, you talked about working your first job at Cadbury's, and then you eventually moved to a Cheese Express Dairy Foods and Samuel South Beer,
mm-hmm,
two different companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got this, you applied at Coca-Cola, mm-hmm, with a lot of other people, like 50 other applicants, mm-hmm, or something,
yep,
and you got the position there as national account manager. You got married, and then you got this incredible offer from Philip Morris that you couldn't turn down, that you were hoping that Coca-Cola would have offered you.
Yeah, I was hoping to stay with Coke and get a marketing job, but they offered me the marketing job, so that's why I went out to the Middle East. Yeah,
and so you're in Bahrain, and how are you, like, getting connected and into the community there?
Well, it's Bahrain's about 80% Arabic. That may sound, well, of course it is, it's Bahrain. But if you go to somewhere like Saudi Arabia, it's only about 22% Saudis. If you go to the UAE, it's about the same, I think, 22, 23% UAE nationals. So most of the labor brought in to do the infrastructure and everything is foreign labor from India, or Pakistan, Lebanon. For example, when I ran a bottling plant in Saudi Arabia, I had 116 nationalities reporting to me. So, you know, it's a very diverse cultural area. So what was your question again?
My question was, like, how did you get connected into the community,
right?
See, where everything is
down this rabbit hole again.
Yeah, well, it's good. It's good. Yeah.
So,
because there's a lot to share.
Well, first of all, you get connected with the people you're working with. And the Philip Morris office was about, wasn't that big, probably eight people, to run the whole of the Middle East. We were just getting started then. It did grow over the time as we grew our market share, but there were only about 8 people. Again, different nationalities, Egyptian, Greek. My boss was English. The guy who worked for me was English. And I can't remember, there were a couple of other nationalities in there. And so one of the first things that hit me is, first of all, you get to learn a lot more about other people's cultures and nationalities very quickly, because they invite you to your homes, and that's a little piece of somebody else's country.
Right.
So you get to know people through the people you work with, but also different cultures. You become very international very quickly. The way that I started to broaden my social was through sport. Yeah, I played soccer there. I played for we had 10 expatriate teams, and they were Indian expatriate teams, English expatriate teams. There were some Greek teams. There were different nationalities that had their own teams, and we'd all play against each other in this league. And so mine was predominantly British for obvious reasons. And that's where I started my infrastructure of social. So a lot of the guys, I got to know them. We got to know their wives. When you live overseas in an international community, especially somewhere like Bahrain, where there isn't really the theatre to go to, there's not the right cultures that you'd normally have back here,
yeah,
or indeed from the UK where I came from, you tend to do a lot more outdoor stuff. So you go out in the boats, you barbecue together, and you socialise, and you do a lot more dinner parties. And of course, in those days, there wasn't a lot of digital access. So you actually spoke to each other.
Yeah, right.
Novel, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't have people sitting at a dinner table fiddling on their phones. Now, the downside of that is, well, we drank a lot more. Because what else do you do while you're chatting?
Yeah, right.
So we had some interesting parties, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how it started from sport. I ended up running a half marathon while I was down there. Didn't train for it. Thought as I played soccer, I'd be able to do it. So, and I did. I couldn't move for about 2 days afterwards, but I did it. I did it in 1 hour 42, I think. And then still got the certificate. And then I did various other running things as well, but mostly soccer was the thing that kept me going.
And how did you build out the Philip Morris company?
Well, that was much more of a team thing. We were, our biggest competition was, funnily enough, English tobacco companies that had been there for a long time. And so our biggest challenge was to introduce Marlboro and flavored tobacco, if you like, which is very different from English tobacco, and get consumers to enjoy it. And so one of the things that we did, we initiated a Marlboro rally team to get coverage around the Gulf states. So I originally looked after 6 countries, which were the 6 Gulf countries: Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, Qatar, and Oman. That's my initial responsibility. And so we did it on several fronts. We did it with awareness, and we did it on sampling. And the rally team...
Sampling of the products?
Of the product.
I see.
The rally team was very successful. It was based on the model that was in Europe for rallies. So fast saloon cars that anybody could own, but they were souped up. And I found a driver from the UAE, a Dubai national, who had been messing around with cars, and we saw some talent in him. We ended up taking him to the UK and training him, and he ended up becoming the Middle East rally driver champion for 4 years in a row. But keeping him disciplined to arrive on time and to do the training was intense. And I'll give you a quick side story on that. He won the Middle East rally in his first year. Very acclaimed. Mohammed bin Salem was his name. He became a friend of mine. And so I took him to Paris to get his award. And all of the big awards for Formula One, for rallying, are all made once a year in Paris, which is the home of motorsport, in effect. And I got to the hotel in time to get him, and I rang up to his room, no answer. And I knew this would be an issue because he was traditionally late for everything. So I got security to go up and bang on the door. And when that didn't work, I went up and banged on the door, and he was asleep. And so finally we got him up. He dressed in his national dress from the UAE,
okay,
got him into a cab. By now, we're already 30 minutes late already in Paris traffic.
Oh.
30 minutes late for his slot, which would be in front of all the cameras, national and international media, receiving his trophy.
Oh my gosh.
And we'd already been briefed on this and spent the afternoon with certain. One of the people we'd spent the afternoon with was one of the Formula One drivers, who, Niki Lauda, who actually had won that year, and Austrian, delightful man. And we ended up being late. So I walked in, and Charles Stewart was the name of our agency at the time, motorsport agency, dedicated to Philip Morris, said, don't worry. I said, why? He said, Lauda's late too. We're going to put you both up together on the stage, which was a coup because nobody knew Mohamed bin Sulayem. But he'd been on stage with Niki Lauda, just won the Formula One, which everybody, anybody to do with racing follows, he was an international star.
So he got even more publicity than he would have.
Complete luck. Great story, but complete luck.
Yeah, right.
Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it helped my career.
Okay. Terrific. So how did you build out Philip Morris?
Well, we...
In the region.
Yeah, we did a couple of things that were unique. We merchandised. So we had our product, all that learning that I had at Cadbury's about where to put the product for impulse.
Yeah, right.
Started
product
to come
placement.
To light. Right?
Okay.
So it was product placement. It wasn't so much, and you can call that distribution in a way, but it was unique the way we bought special stands. We had a guy called Chris Moore, who's still a good mate of mine, lives in France now, put together these illuminated areas where we could display the product in a different way. Don't forget, we're talking about, even in those days, it was the Marlboro Man,
yeah.
The cowboy.
Yeah.
And so
I remember the commercials.
Right. And so we used...
When they were allowed commercials.
When they were allowed. And in fact, it's interesting, the Middle East was... use of promotional materials was banned in the Middle East earlier than most other countries around the world. And the reason for that, even though smoking was huge down there, the Arab League and the people that ran the countries down there wanted to be seen as leaders in health around the world. And so quite a dichotomy, really, in many ways. But they became a leader in starting to stop cigarette brands using their branded use of the word Marlboro. So we actually had to come up with some unique ways of showing our branding without saying the word Marlboro. So we had something called the rooftop. Some people call it the chevron. So we'd use that to identify it as being Marlboro. And often what happened is people just, they saw the word Marlboro even though it wasn't written there because the rooftop signified the brand. So
it's kind of like the arches in McDonald's. Like you don't even need the word there because everybody knows the
symbol. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The apple with apple and so on.
Right.
Yeah, the icons.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. That's a good analogy. And so that was very successful. And we were one of the first people to start doing that. So, and so we gained market share very quickly in all the markets. And then they expanded my area to, I thought I'd be down there for 3 years, and then they asked me to make it six and expanded my area outside to countries like Yemen and Syria. And
how big of a team did you work with?
I had by the time I left, we had a team of about 20. So we'd grown from eight. And I had a team of five that worked directly for me in the marketing department. And then I obviously had several agencies that helped us with media. We spent a lot on media. Yeah. $50 million on media.
That is a
per
lot.
Per year.
So, for 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Per year. So you had a lot of opportunity to do a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it had to be. We even came up with Marlboro Leisurewear, which is another way of round the code, if you like. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Of not saying directly what the name is
of
the product.
Yeah, it was linked to leisurewear rather than just being to cigarettes. But
yeah. I see.
Indirect advertising.
Right. Exactly. And then there was some way that your career path led you back to Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Where you developed some distribution process.
No, it was more because I had been in the Middle East now for 5 to 6 years, spoke some Arabic, obviously knew the demographics extremely well, had traveled the area quite well. By complete coincidence, my boss's boss from Coca-Cola became in charge of the Middle East division president. And he occasionally used to ring me up on trips down to Bahrain and say, hey, can we go out for dinner and maybe you can tell me a bit about the market and what's going on? And we had a few of these. And I said, so wait a minute, what do you mean you're division president of the Middle East? You guys are not in the Middle East, he said, I know, but we're working on it. I said, okay, well, I'm happy to help you any way I can. You know, I still have a great affinity to the company. And, you know, I wouldn't have left it, you guys give me a marketing job. So he said, he laughed about it. Anyway, a couple of months later, he rang me up and said, look, I've got a proposition for you. Let's have dinner and just the two of us. He'd normally bring his some of his team in with him for us to have those other dinners. And I knew about half of them already from my old days. And they'd worked around the world, some of them from South Africa. And so that dinner was, look, we are very close to getting back into the Middle East. By the way, the background was we were put on the Arab boycott list for 22 years. When the Arab League came to both Coke and Pepsi and a number of other companies, Ford, Cadbury's, and said, you got a choice to make. You can move out of Israel and you can stay in the Middle East, or you can stay in Israel, but you're out of the Middle East. And some companies made different decisions based on what their priorities were for whatever reason. And I don't want to get into politics, but we chose to stay in Israel for a number of reasons. Again, I don't want to get into the reason that was given to us is because we went there first, and therefore we feel loyal that because we were there first.
Sure.
Pepsi, on the other hand, decided to pull out of Israel. And so therefore, as a result, they had a monopoly on the soft drink market for 22 years. And so when we when Jeff Unsworth was his name, was talking to me about this job, it was bringing Coke back into the Middle East after a 22-year break. So huge
opportunity
and B challenge. And so I accepted the job. He offered it, ended up offering me a job as marketing manager, which is what the job I wanted before I left.
So somehow it came back around.
Yeah.
In a better way than you might have thought.
Yeah. And with a brand, I never really wanted to leave. Always loved Coca-Cola. Loved the people, like working for them, like the brand.
Yeah.
And so it became the best, probably the best of the two jobs I've ever had, because I worked on my own. Mm-hmm. Nobody was with, we didn't have an office there. I had to start it virtually from scratch with somebody else, finding the canning plant, producing the cans in one place down in Muscat, Oman, shipping them over to the various other Gulf states as soon as we got permission to go in, helping find the bottlers, who were our franchise distributing system, help them understand how to get the trucks painted to pattern, help them hire the salesman. I mean, I did really everything from, I even did some interviews.
You were chief cook and bottle washer?
Wow, that's a good one. I like that. Actually, it was at the time it was can, so
yeah, right.
So it was can puller or something. But anyway, yeah,
there
but
we
pretty
go.
Close.
Yeah,
but did pretty much everything, which was great because I learned the business in a slightly different way. So it was exciting too.
And how did you set up the distribution?
The distribution system was something that we did many, many years ago. But of course, all our markets were so sophisticated by then. This was to do this from scratch. I found a guy who was Italian, Antonello Bonanno.
So this is the, I just want to reinforce that this is opportunity. Like you're able to and pull together the resources. Like you saw the opportunity and then you're like, how can we make this work?
Yeah.
And so you pulled together these different resources that came together in pretty uncanny way.
Yeah, they really were. Actually, that's a great way to describe it because I'd known Antonello for years and I'd heard he was a distribution guru, right? He knew what he was talking about. And so I phoned him up one day and said, if I can get permission to get you out here, would you come down? And he said, they've been talking about moving me to the Middle East division. That would be perfect. Yeah. So anyway, he flew down. And I said, how do you do this distribution stuff? You know, how do you plan a route? Or as you would call it, a route, right? So how do you do that? And he said, well, do you want to do it? I said, well, there's only two of us. I guess we're going to have to. So it was July. In Bahrain, it's around 95 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit with humidity to around 85 to 90%.
Yeah.
So I said, how do we do this then?
Yeah, goes, right.
We go out in the car and we walk the streets and we go up and we cut out a piece of the map and we walk up and down every single street to where any beverage would be sold, and we mark them on the map, and we get the name of that place, and we write them all down. I said, okay. Population of about 500,000 in Bahrain, so not huge by any means, right? But still, a lot of legwork to cover. And so I said, let me show me how it works, and then maybe we'll start delegating some of this. So anyway, we did this for a week. And what you do is you make a note of all of these outlets and what the route would probably be, because you're walking it and imagining where a truck would have to pull up, what one-way streets. You get back into the office and you take this list and type them into a computer, and then you cut up the paper for each of those individual outlets. You roll them up like a little piece of paper, roll it up.
Sure.
And you put it on a pin.
Yeah.
And you put the pin into the map.
Okay.
And you gradually build those pins up with all the names of the outlets until you can do a route. And then you say, okay, that's 16. That's probably as many as they can do in a day, maybe 20. You then start taking them all off again, putting them back in the computer in a route now, rather than just a random number of outlets. And that's how you build your routes up over a period of time.
For all the trucks and the delivery trucks.
Correct. And how the distribution would happen. And you make, by the way, when you're on those calls, physical calls, you're asking the owners of the how many soft drinks they buy, how many cases they buy a week. So you can start building up what the load's going to be for each truck. It's because you have to estimate that.
Sure.
So that's pretty much how we did it. And then after 2 weeks of doing this, we started to hire students in to help us do it, train them, and so they could carry on doing the work. So it was great for me, because I learned ground up how this thing works.
Yeah.
And actually, we ended up writing the manual on it.
Okay.
Yeah. It was part of the process. So, yeah.
So
a process again.
Your favorite thing. Well, and it's not just a process, because it seems like you also, you know, that's how you reach your outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got a book out of it, you know, a training manual.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, we ended up writing how we'd actually entered the markets. Yeah. And that was one facet of it, distribution. The rest was marketing and other things that we did. Now, what was exciting for me is I was the only guy actually based in Bahrain. So the teams that helped me, because I obviously couldn't do all of that on my own, they flew in for periods of time and then flew out again. But I was the only one on the ground for about 18 months.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I went to Cyprus for 3 weeks and lay prone because I was so tired and exhausted.
Yeah.
Because it was a 7-day-a-week job.
Yeah. You had to get it done too. There's some time frame that you had to work within.
And we had all sorts of issues. Packing the containers wrongly. So the first time we opened the containers at the Bahrain port, up in the back of the container, Coke just spilled out. The cans were all loose. Nobody had packed them in cases properly. There was syrup everywhere. Those are the kind of things we had to put up with.
Okay, yeah, and deal with different packaging.
Why are you doing this? Why, you know, we were dealing with people who hadn't been in the business before because it was all new.
Yeah.
And we were training them.
So you were training them as you went along.
And we were learning a few things too.
I'm sure. Yeah. Terrific. All right. Well, we're at the end of another conversation. This is great. Lots of background. We still haven't made it to the United States. Do you think we could have another conversation?
I think so, yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for putting your life on the line. And really drumming up all the memories, you know, from that time, the details of it. All right. Thanks, sound engineer, photographer, videographer, mon frère, brother from another mother. Thank you for all your work that you do. There's the sign of the cross. A final blessing for this episode. And thanks, listeners, for tuning in. Remember, as you're growing your business, don't allow yourself to get isolated. There are lots of resources. So check out the small emerging growth companies, mentoring organizations in your area. Check out wementor.com and get involved with some other people. You'll find the resources that you need to help your life growing your business be a lot more fun. All right, we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for tuning in.